This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The world is a depressing place. Powerful elites perpetuate injustices that you hear about every day on this program. But you also hear, more importantly, about how people fight back and resist. Today, we're going to examine the creative side of resistance, what my guest calls tactical performance, which is, quote, direct action and theatrical confrontation with some of the most powerful institutions in the world. Larry Bogat is an associate professor of political performance at the University of California, Davis, and the founding director of the Center for Tactical Performance. He's written a number of plays, including Haymarket, Tahrir, COINTELSHOW, A Patriot Act, and EconoMusic, Keeping Score. He's the author of Electoral Guerrilla Theater, Radical Ridicule and Social Movements, and he now joins me to discuss his new book called Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. Welcome to the program, Larry.
Thank you so much, Nolly.
So you open your book with talking about the history of tactical performance in the United States that goes back to at least the lunch counter protest of the South during the civil rights movement, when black activists sat at lunch counters, simply sat at lunch counters where they were, of course, banned from entering and tried to eat their food while they essentially, conducted a sit-in. Why was that, in your view, tactical performance?
Well, one thing that the civil rights movement needs credit for, and a lot of the people who did these actions, is that they thought of what they were doing as performance, and they strategized, and they used terms like sociodrama and creative suffering to help them plan what they were doing. So they conceived of this as an intervention that had a practical impact right there, right at the point of articulation of white supremacist power, for sure, but also would be very electrifying and horrifying for people around the world who saw it. So this kind of creative suffering was very heavily rehearsed and very highly disciplined. They realized that when they go there and they have total emotional discipline, and they neither go to fight nor flight, but stick to their script, rehearsed in the backstage of history, so they'd be ready. When they were attacked, they remained nonviolent. And that wasn't just to be passive in any way. It was highly savvy because of the context of the Cold War and everything that was happening in the world. They were putting pressure on the authorities to intervene against this Jim Crow laws. So I think, in fact, Dr. King was interviewed once on Meet the Press. And the interviewer said, why are you doing these sit-ins? Your people are getting beaten and arrested. Why don't you just stick to the boycotts and things like that? And he just said very clearly, you know what? Sometimes we have to dramatize the issues. And people don't understand what's happening. We need to tell the story in a way that everyone will understand. So those interventions provoked predictable responses of violence. And then that basically they created a scene where their more powerful opponents actually suffered political loss because they didn't understand they were walking into a play that the civil rights movement had written.
And then fast forward several decades later, during the Bush era here in the United States, when there were mass protests on the streets of cities around the country against the Iraq War and against the sort of pro-corporate policies of the U.S. government, you had this emergence of this creative sort of group called the Billionaires for Bush. I remember seeing Billionaires for Bush here in Southern California, where I'm located. They became the sort of nationwide theatrical framework that people could sort of dress up and use to express or to visualize who the real constituency of the government was. What was your involvement with the Billionaires for Bush?
Well, I played the role of Ollie Gark. We all had names like that were just really bad jokes. But I was Ollie, and as Ollie of the Gark family, I would do what everyone else was doing in the group, sort of articulating with an ironic voice and a playful voice the class warfare that was happening and continues, obviously. So as the voice of the 0.00001%, we really wanted to make it clear how we supported Bush and why. So we had signs like Free the Forbes 500, Dick Cheney is Innocent, which I liked. And things like that, where if you just looked for a second, you know, we had a bumper sticker, small government, big wars, Billionaires for Bush. You know, so the idea was just to make people go, wait, are you guys serious? Oh, no, I get it. So the use of irony in that case was just to draw people in maybe a little bit more consistently than if we were doing a more predictable form of protest where sometimes people turn off or tune out because they've seen it before.
So that's a bit of playfulness. The Billionaires for Bush was different from the lunch counter sit-ins for many, many reasons, but also specifically because this was people actually doing theater, literally play acting, right? Sort of from a theoretical perspective, because your book sort of examines this theory, how are these two different kinds of tactical performance?
Yeah, I mean, the billionaires were a little limited in their range of action. They tended to not do things like civil disobedience and actually breaking the law. It would be a bit out of character for oligarchs to do that. You know, we just have our assistants do that if we need to, or our servants. So it's a different level of engagement. Obviously, it's, and I will just say, less important than the civil rights movement, less dignified. It's more of a mediagenic action. I would say it's to create confusion in the moment, and then some wonderful media intervention moments that go out onto the web or sometimes infiltrate onto CNN because it's so ridiculous. But again, yeah, I would say they're cousins. I wouldn't say they're entirely unrelated, because people now have learned from our ancestors, theoretically, in the civil rights movement, a lot about thinking theatrically.
And it's
kind of looking very different.
It's not just costumes, right, that are part of tactical performance. It's also props. And I remember during the global justice movement, sort of in the years before the September 11th attacks, during the Battle of Seattle, during the sort of second half of the 90s, early 2000s, a lot of activist groups in the U.S. developed these huge, elaborate, and low-cost props, giant puppets and stuff, that became irresistible photo ops for the mainstream media, which is part of this sort of tactical performance goal, I think, in our modern day. Tell us about that aspect of it, the props aspect of social protest and confrontation.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so important. And I like that you emphasize the low-cost nature of a lot of these things.
I actually was involved during the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles in 2000 in making one of these giant puppets. But
That's great. It's satisfying, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm part of that. You know, this is, yeah, I mean, puppets in particular, they're very cheap to make, but they do take a lot of labor, of course. My dear colleague, David Solnit, is a wonderful practitioner of this form and has done wonderful things with his colleagues on there using puppets. They're like cartoon characters in that you can invest into them, meaning they're beautiful, but also they're not photorealistic, which is great. So it's something different. They're characters you can identify with in that sense. They're more open. I'll never forget being in CISPAS and doing a protest against U.S. involvement, supporting the death squads in El Salvador. Bread and Puppet came with an enormous Archbishop Romero puppet that was, he was a martyred, of course, as you know, religious leader there who spoke against the death squads. So to have that enormous, enormous puppet with us was almost like his spirit looming over us. And it's something that is ineffable, but it can give you more encouragement. It also communicates really clearly. Like if the media only shows 1 second, but they show your puppet and your puppet's well designed, or it could be your puppet, costumes, whatever you're wearing. If it can tell your story in one instant, that's kind of the sweet spot, because they're not going to give you a lot of time. And in fact, what they're saying underneath may be very derogatory, the corporate media.
Right.
But you know what I mean? But if your puppet tells your story, at least you have it.
Right, and I want to actually turn to that. The work that you do with the tactical performance is international, and one of the sort of movements you've been involved in, I understand it's mostly based in Europe, is a clown army that has helped to create images of protests that have been dissonant with the media narrative. Tell us about the rebel clown army in various European countries.
Very dignified organization, the clandestine insurgent rebel clown army. Yeah,
the clandestine insurgent rebel clown army.
Oh yeah,
yes.
We were trying to hit as many searches, like if they were looking for dissidents, just find us and then see us in our ridiculous costumes on the web. That's kind of our goal. So we had all those hot words in the name. I mean, the idea of the clown army, and it spread here, by the way, which was very gratifying to some of us, where we kind of stopped doing it, but we had our top secret training manual on our website that you could just download for free.
Very top secret.
Yeah, very top. We're very, very exclusive. But then there have been Klan rallies and neo-Nazi rallies, both in the United States and even kind of fascist paramilitary groups in Finland recently, where they're doing their march and a bunch of clowns show up and basically confuse them and burst the bubble of the – they want to create an atmosphere of hatred and terror and horror. And then to have clowns that obviously have contempt for them but are expressing it through playfulness and ridicule, it can be a wonderful thing. So I'm happy to see that that kind of mode has continued to spread in a way. We basically were trained. We started in 2003 in the UK when I was teaching at the University of Birmingham. And my dear friend John Jordan said, let's have an army of clowns. What does that look like? And we started to combine our various skill sets. So there's Theater of the Oppressed by Bawal, group comedy improv, obviously proper clowning, and nonviolent civil disobedience, of course. You have to have that in there. So we had this very strange combination of training techniques. And the idea with that bizarre mix is that we could both ramp down the automatic behaviors at a protest. Because when a phalanx of 150 clowns show up and start looking for weapons of mass destruction up people's noses, you know, and things like that, it at least stops the kind of boring and automatic behavior. It even stops the police often, where they're kind of shoving people and they kind of stop like, what's going on? So, you know, we had different rules of engagement depending on which police force and how hardcore they were, how we would act. But there were definitely moments where we created what I like to think of as irresistible images, images that even your ideological opponent will reproduce, because it's poetic. It tells your story and it defuses the stereotypes of the movement. And even like a right-wing horrible tabloid will blow it up and put it in the paper because it's just such an image.
And in fact, you have in your book an example of a right-wing media outlet referring to protesters in the headline as violent, but then having this image that they just couldn't resist publishing of a clown kissing a police's riot gear.
Right, yeah. And again, it's almost like a reverse caption to their article that's like, don't believe everything they're saying here. And, you know, it doesn't work every time. And I don't want to overstate the importance because there's so many other things that are important for protest. But the idea is to create a space that's participatory and that everyone feels empowered to bring something to it. And that's surprising. I think surprise is important for this art form of mass protest.
Now, Larry, you talk in your book about the fact that the array of people and the array of forces that the rest of us, that ordinary people, you know, resist and fight against, are very, very organized and, of course, have lots and lots of money, which is what makes them powerful. So they have think tanks and strategizing, and they employ whole armies of people to study the strategy of the rest of us. And they're often one step ahead. I mean, serious lessons were learned from the anti-Vietnam War protests, from the 1960s radical movements. And often corporate and government elites have been one step ahead of activists. And you use the analogy of a chess game where activists have unfortunately often played the game as amnesiac chess players. Can you elaborate on that a little further and explain how it is really important for resistance movements to study corporate and government elite behavior to try to be a better chess player, if you will?
Yeah. And, you know, it's not meant as a put down to our movements. It's just a question of resources. You know, there are these think tanks and the Pentagon has, you know, they're very highly paid people with great benefits who keep track of, okay, for on the behalf of the state or corporations, what worked last time? What didn't work? What did they do that set us, you know, that set us back? And we have some wonderful groups that are doing this work. I mean, and training and skill sharing. So these things exist. But it's hard because we have fewer resources. So I just think it's something important to emphasize is to share our stories, not just of the, you know, good tactics, but of our mistakes and setbacks so we learn from each other. And there are groups, I'm happy to say, that do trainings, et cetera, the Rocket Society, et cetera, which is wonderful. But it's important to keep doing that and amplifying that, like preserving our counter-institutional memory. We've made a lot of mistakes too. And one thing I've learned the hard way, my own making mistakes, is sort of like, trying to do the same thing exactly the same way twice. And the state they're paying attention. They're not a block of wood. And they will correct, you know, they'll find a tactic that diffuses your weird prank idea that you had. You have to change it up.
You've worked with groups like the Yes Men, who've taken this idea of creative tactical performance to a whole nother level, where they essentially impersonate corporate PR executives. They've snuck into headquarters of corporations. They've even actually been interviewed as fake spokespeople. How important is, you know, taking it that to that level? I mean, the Yes Men, these two guys, between the two of them, managed to get sort of outsized media coverage, if you will, for the number of people that are actually involved. And is that really important to try to kind of maximize your footprint on in the media?
You know, I think it's one really important goal. Sometimes we make the mistake of fetishizing getting into the media to the detriment of other things. So I would say it's amazing, but also that those kinds of wonderful spectacular pranks ideally are connected to sort of the daily grind of a campaign, a labor campaign, you know, human rights or environmental justice campaign. So I like to think of it as a mix of sort of the air war and ground war I hate to use military terms, but just purely for a metaphor, you know, that the kind of big air war parallel is sort of these big pranks, like we made a fake New York Times and mass distributed it with all the news we wanted to see, a New York Post, an International Herald Tribune. These were fake papers that really got a lot of attention because you're not supposed to do that. So that's great. But those kinds of things work when you're joined up with the quote unquote ground forces. In other words, everyday organizing in neighborhoods and towns or a specific strike or action. So I like to think that they work together in combination, ideally. The media coverage is important, but ideally it's done in a way that people have a specific way. Once they see it and they're turned on and they think that was really clever, now they know there's a place they can go to get involved.
What happens when people actually fall for the prank? People that you don't mean for them to fall for the prank, people that are supposed to be on your side?
Yeah, that's a problem. It's definitely a problem. You know, so with the billionaires for Bush, for example, I mean, the clown army is clearly absurd. We never had that problem right. with the clown, thank goodness. But with something like billionaires for Bush, because it's so ironic, there's some folks who are irony deficient. And so they may be like, wow, there's actual rich people here who support Bush. And then you're like, we didn't really reach out to these labor guys or whoever it is that we're demonstrating. We're actually helping their demonstration or trying to. And they're like, these rich Republicans here are annoying. And we're like, oh no, this is ironic. We're trying to get more media towards your labor action, actually. So there's times where it's a combination of not being fully organized and just reaching out and communicating to everyone ahead of time. Everyone should be on the same page when you have a combination of earnest and silly or ironic protesters. Everyone should actually know what's going on. The other thing is it can be a question of acting style. This is very Brechtian, not to get too hoity-toity with the theory, but to me, this kind of prank reveals itself in the moment. We're not actually trying to fool anyone. We leave that to the neoconservatives to actually deliberately lie in the media. our goal is to do something that's, oh, really? Oh, I get it. You know, we want to give people a chance to figure it out within the first 5 seconds and say, I get it. I see what you're doing. Right. So again, it's more for surprise and engagement. And so sometimes those mistakes are made. The acting style is too straightforward. And this is the kind of thing I try to work on in my workshops or in the classes I teach at Davis, is we practice and role play.
Right. This isn't just something that you do without thinking. There's a lot of planning involved. There's workshopping. You basically train yourself to do whatever tactical performance you decide upon. And then, as you said earlier, probably not do the same thing twice. The other aspect of it, finally, that I wanted to talk about, Larry, is the importance of creativity and just plain fun in our movements. Our movements can be dreary and depressing because the issues we deal with are dreary and depressing. Death, you know, injustice, it's very hard to keep your spirits up often when you're deeply involved as an organizer. But maybe to dress up as a clown raises the levity not just for yourself and your fellow organizers, but the people on the street that you're trying to win over and hopefully get media attention, right? Do all of these sort of things work in concert in a positive way?
I hope so. I mean, I think the idea, this is a great question, by the way, I appreciate it. I try to think of it in terms of charismatic action. Like, what kind of action is going to attract more people who are in a more enthusiastic way? And it doesn't always have to be silly or funny, but that helps. Sometimes it's just super creating beautiful images that are mournful or elegiac, but you know, like, but still someone says, gee, I'd like to be part of that. That was beautiful. So I think it can range from somber to serious, et cetera, to playful. But I think that is part of it is that it sustains us. We believe in sustainability, right? We believe in permaculture. That applies for the sound health and body and mind of activists too. And to prevent burnout, I think being creative is a really important way to make it sustainable and to get more people involved because it's more fun. I think the cliched forms of protest sometimes are a turnoff. It's almost like being an agnostic and going to church just because when you go to the demo because you know you're supposed to, but it's kind of locked down. You're just supposed to listen to the expert speak on stage and quietly listen. I understand there's reasons for that format, but it is a very old format. And there's something to be said for mixing it up and creating a space. We're actually not just occupying the space, which is important, but opening up the space for mass creativity. And I think it just creates a more joyful space. We want to give a vision of the world that we're trying to build, not only we get to talk about what we're against, as important as that is.
Well, Larry, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with your new book.
Thank you, Sonali. I really appreciate it.
Larry Bogad is an associate professor of political performance at the University of California, Davis, founding director of the Center for Tactical Performance. His earlier book was Electoral Guerrilla Theater, Radical Ridicule and Social Movements, just out in a second edition. His new book that we've just been discussing is Tactical Performance, the Theory and Practice of Serious Play. And by the way, if you watch the video of this interview, you can see some of the beautiful and funny and creative visuals of the movements that we were talking about. All of our interviews are videotaped and available online at our website, risingupwithsonali.com. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.